is made possible by the View Conference, the biggest computer graphics conference in Italy. Our dates for 2023 are from the 15th to the 20th of October. We hope to see you in Italy or online. For more information about View Conference, please visit our website, viewconference.it.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. And welcome to today's preview discussion panel of five Oscar contenders for Best Animated Short. I'm Dan Sarto. I'm the publisher and editor-in-chief at Animation World Network, AWN.com, and VFX World. And it's really a great pleasure to be here with you today to talk about some great films and some great artists who made those films. For the next hour or so, we're going to do a deep dive into the minds of these filmmakers, who I will introduce in a moment. They're here. We're going to take advantage of this unique gathering. We're going to pepper them with all sorts of questions. Hopefully they haven't heard them 8,000 times over the last few months. But if they have, I'm sure they'll be a good sport and answer them as if it was the first time they've heard it. First, I want to thank Dr. Maria Elena Gutierrez, who introduced herself, the director of the View Conference, one of my favorite events to go to on the annual event schedule. She's a singular force of nature and one of the most thoughtful, passionate, and energetic voices in the animation, visual effects, gaming, and transmedia industries. And I want to thank her and the View Conference for hosting this panel. So let's jump into this now. This year's selection of Oscar-contending animated shorts is as strong a field as I've ever seen, showcasing a wide range of state-of-the-art visual styles across 2D, 3D, stop motion. But equally important, just compelling, well-crafted storytelling that makes such innovative and effective use of the medium of animation to capture our hearts and capture our attention with compelling stories. It's one of the reasons why, of all the things that I get to see and cover with Animation World Network, I've always loved the shorts because they're also varied and they're also personal. We have the directors, filmmakers of each of the five nominated films with us today. We're going to do our best to entice them to share insights about their films, the paths they took to tell such wonderful stories, the challenges they all faced working in such a time-consuming and pretty demanding medium, as you guys all know, and what they hope audiences like you take away after enjoying their celebrated work. So quickly, we're going to introduce them. We're going to say hi, and then we're going to get into some questions. So we have Peter Bainton, with The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse. We have Amanda Forbes and Wendy Tilby, who made The Flying Sailor. We have Joao Gonzalez, who made Ice Merchants. We have Sarah Gunnar's daughter and Pamela Ribbon from My Year of Dicks. And last but not least, Lachlan Pendergan, who made An Ostrich Told Me the World is Fake and I Think I Believe It. First of all, congratulations to all of you. Good luck at the Oscars and welcome. Thanks for joining us. Peter, I'm going to start with you. You tell us a little bit about the origins and inspirations behind this film? You had a great night on Saturday night at the Annies, and shared some of your thoughts in accepting some awards. So why don't you tell us, where did this film begin? How did it all start?
It started with Charlie Mackesy, who's who directed the film with me, and he also co-wrote it. And he's an English artist. I think back at maybe a good 5, 6, 7 years ago, he started doing these drawings of a boy, a mole, a fox, and a horse. Mostly kind of, I think, out of conversations he was having with friends. And he would do these sort of drawings with these little captions of, attached to them and sort of share them. He started putting them on Instagram, and they drew a following. They seemed to sort of reach people and affect people. And it grew as a sort of Instagram phenomenon, really. He was asked to make a book which is a collection of those drawings. Eventually he was approached by Bad Robot, and also Hannah Mangella from Bad Robot and Kara Speller from Non-More Productions. and to make a film. So that's the kind of origins, and the film really is our best attempt at a faithful adaptation of the book, and to try and achieve some of the effects that the book has had, basically.
What do you dream about?
Home.
What's that like?
I don't know, but I know I need one.
So, what are we doing?
We're on a quest for cake.
Well, let's get going then.
You are loved, and you bring to this world things that no one else can.
Whoa! What's the bravest thing you've ever said?
Help. Asking for help isn't giving up. It's refusing to give up.
Amanda, Wendy, let's go next to you. Tell us about the flying sailor. I will mention very quickly that I actually was at that museum in Halifax, and I remember looking out around going, oh my goodness, you know, you when you're there, it's a very different experience.
Yeah, it's a pretty vivid experience. For those who don't know, our film is based on a real life story that occurred in Halifax in 1917, where two ships collided and one blew up and basically blew down half of the town of Halifax. And one of the stories that really struck us was, because there are a lot of very striking stories, was about a sailor who was on the pier, and he was thrown by the explosion 2 kilometers and lived, arriving on the ground, conscious, wearing nothing but one boot. And so we saw that at the Maritime Museum in Halifax. And the question that really excited us was, what was that trip like? And we held on to that question for about 16 years while we were doing other things. And then finally got around to starting it up in about 2018.
So it percolated all that time. What made it finally the time to tell that story?
Ooh, I think, well, we had been doing, well, we did another film in between called Wildlife. That was one thing. And we also did a lot of commercial work and some ballet projections, all sorts of things. And we realized that time was ticking and we needed to do another film. And we thought, what are we going to do? Well, we dusted off The Flying Sailor. And not that it was that dusty.
It was a little dusty.
It was a little dusty. But we're kind of glad we waited, because I think it weirdly was gestating all that time. And I think we made a better film now than we probably would have 20 years ago. But it just seemed, it also seemed an extension of our earlier work. It seemed like some of the things we were trying to get at conceptually in the previous two films came to the fore in The Flying Sailor, which is really kind of the distillation of a life.
Joao, why don't you tell us a little bit about the origins and inspiration behind Ice Merchants?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. So in my case, my films normally always start from an image or a scenario that comes from my subconscious. In this case, it was an image of the tiny house attached to a cliff. You know those feelings when you're just about to fall asleep and then you're like in this amazing place, and then you actually think about it and the image disappears and it's very frustrating. I like to pick to pick those images as a starting point for my films, because I know that I consciously already have a connection with it, with some sort. And my challenge is always to try find a way of using those surrealistic landscapes and use them in a metaphorical way to talk about things that are personal and dear to me. So in this case, I knew from the beginning it was going to be a film about loss. And that's my starting point. I have a scenario and I have a feeling that I know I want to study and dive into. And the more that I dive into the world where the film is going to take place, I draw a lot about the world. I write a lot about the world. I start to have more concise ideas for the actual structure of the film. At the same time, I start to also compose the soundtrack of the film. So juggling between writing, drawing, writing, and composing the music, something like starts to appear more concise. And that's where I start from there, yeah.
So from the time you kind of first started with the imagery, the germ of the idea, how long did it take before you were pretty sure this is the film you're going to do?
I would say the pre-production was around 1 or 2 months. In my pre-production, for me, it's very important not only to establish the structure of the film, but also assert the visual aesthetics and the film's tone above all. So when I start composing the music in the first place, I'm not very as interested in knowing exactly how long is the like music going to be and how it's going to combine with each moment of the film. It's more about trying to find, in this case, like a melancholic tone that I know that if I keep playing it and I keep improvising on it, it will give me more ideas for the actual narrative of the film. So it's like a generating process, just juggling between both areas really helps to have a more concise idea. And I feel like it also helps me personally to make something more creative because everything is like blooming out at the same time.
Sara and Pamela, why don't you share a little bit about how your work came about? What was the origins of the story, and what inspired you to make it?
I think Pam should start with that one because it's her story.
And it starts from a long time ago. I wrote a lot of notes to boys, and I kept all the first drafts. And I wasn't really someone who kept a diary. I sort of did it through writing to people. And at some point, I published them. I'm jumping ahead to say I made a memoir about my years in high school. And one of the chapters is about the year I was really determined to lose my virginity to blossom into womanhood, as Pam says in the film. And FX approached me about working in an animation space that was more independent. I'd come from Disney films and Sony animation films, and this was different to do something on a smaller, for me, pipeline. I'd gotten the script greenlit, and then some directors were offered. They had come from Jeanette Janine, who was a producer who had done other work for FX, and she suggested Sada. I saw Sada's work and was like, I want to work with her. Like, let's make this happen. And then Sada ended up bringing Jeanette on board. So we all sort of like we secreted it into existence. So it's Sada. Do you want to talk about when the scripts came to you? Because that's when I think all the magic really started.
Yeah. FX approached me with this and they sent me like 3 out of 5 chapters. And I was really excited about it. I mean, Pam is such a wonderful writer. I mean, I did stuff to try to have them choose me. Like, I put some stuff together, and then I didn't hear from them for 2 months.
And then, that wasn't me. I was sitting at home waiting for her as well.
Yeah, and then we started working, and we spent a year and a half together making this film.
She had all these animators that she had in her head that were friends and people she admired. And the first time we talked, she was like, "I think it's this person for this," and she was showing me all of their work, and it felt very much like writing love letters to each other. Of like, I feel like this when I read this. Like, me too. And it was such the spirit of what this film is about, that I knew we were gonna have so much fun making this, which we did.
Pamela, I wanna ask you know, in keeping these letters, not being a diarist, but keeping these letters that go back to, you know, years ago, along the way, did you ever think that you would do something like this with them, or is that something that came about much later?
Well, I used to tell some of it, like the sex talk was one of my first like one person shows, like it was in there. And then a friend of mine and I put together a comedy show called Letters Never Sent, which was us writing letters to often inanimate objects or concepts. And that was a two-person comedy show that we'd done together. And we took that to Aspen Comedy Festival. So while I might think no, but then there was a letter in that was in that show that was verbatim. I read it to him. I called him and read it to him over the phone after I wrote it. And so in the show, my friend Liz is just cringing behind me. So I suppose I didn't know it would be here and I'd get to meet all of you today and talk to 238 participants. No, you can't have that in your mind when you're 15 and writing, "What is love? Is it measured in raindrops?" Like, no, you can't.
Right.
But I love when things come to you because of the reasons that you've said yes and the places where you've said yes and the people that you've met. And I feel like that is what writing Notes to Boys pretty early on brought to me, was learning who knows how to accept this kind of unabashed love.
This is a story from the year I was determined to lose my virginity, also known as...
Go to bed.
Okay.
And whatever you're watching, cut it out.
It's an art film.
Yeah.
Lachlan, where did your film come from?
Hello everyone. I guess it started for me. I started this research program at my film school, and so it started at me coming to terms with what that was about. Like, how do you what is research? Like, I never really saw myself as that sort of academic sort of type, so I think it started with me just like reading a lot of stuff and trying to understand the origins of animation and stop motion, and just really just digging into things and figuring out a little bit of history, because I really enjoy stop motion and I wanted to kind of figure out what it was that was so charming for me and for what I wanted to emphasize and play around with. And it eventually went down this very sort of meta self-referential route where you are constantly reminded that you're watching something that is handmade. And it was also about this office worker who's living this very mundane life, and I tried to find the humor in that as well.
Wasn't there also, did you tell me last time we spoke, didn't you tell me also that part of making this film was the fact that if you, as part of your doctorate program, if you made a film, you actually didn't have to do other stuff, you could do the film, and that would like give you, that make sure you had something to do for the year that you actually wanted to do?
Well, yeah, the research output is the film, so the film is the research, and so that's a weird thing to like in order to be like, okay, how is that research? You then have to justify that with like a written thesis thing, which that's the part that I feel very out of my depth and had to really learn how to like write academically and stuff like that. And yeah, basically justify everything I'm doing from that research perspective, which is very new to me. And I don't think I would have arrived at the film that I made if it wasn't through that lens.
Ah, Neil. How are your sales coming along?
Oh, they're... oh.
Neil?
Hey, this is gonna sound weird. I think we're living in an artificial universe.
What was that?
An ostrich told me the world is fake, and I think I believe it.
An ostrich?
It's probably easier if you come see for yourself.
Wendy and Amanda, I want to jump back over to you for the next question. Talk a little bit about what inspired the look, you know, the visual style of the film. I know that you've told me before that you brought some 3D into this film that you hadn't done in your previous films. I know that you're very deliberate about both the films you do as well as your style. So this is a little bit of a departure for you. Tell us about the decision making and what you brought into it.
Well, we do come from a strictly 2D painterly kind of a background. And I think we were originally thinking we would stay in that vein. And what we always do at the beginning of every project is we say, okay, this one's going to be fast and loose and inky. And it never turns out that way. It always gets complicated. And we were brought up short against that idea really quickly because we wanted to have some sense of the city below him and this collapsing city. And it gave us the vapors to imagine animating that in 2D. And we do like to change the style to a certain extent every time. It keeps it challenging and keeps it interesting. So we decided to get into 3D, and we hired a Maya animator who helped us build a little city of Halifax and then blow it up. And for that, we decided, with kind of limited resources, that we would go for a kind of a rinky-dink model railway aesthetic, because we like that. You know, everybody loves either very large things or very small things. So the miniature world is kind of appealing. And then we also, in our research, looked at an awful lot of tinted postcards from that era, and we decided to combine those two aesthetics, plus keep the sailor in 2D in our realm so that we could maintain control of him, because we felt that we could create a more sympathetic and interesting character in 2D. And so that's why we stuck with that. We were also really influenced by a lot of archival footage. When we made our original animatic, we were throwing in everything we could think of into the animatic to convey the structure, the shape, the emotional arc, whatever. But we really loved these. We had a lot of World War II stuff of explosions and aerial shots. And we looked at a lot of drone footage, that kind of thing. And so that kind of informed the look. And then we ended up keeping some of the little snippets of live action as the sailors' memories, because they actually work better than anything animated. And it fit in the world of the 3D world that we were working on at the same time.
Shira, what about you? Tell us a little bit about what inspired the look and, you know, the visual style mm-hmm. of your film, the decisions you made and why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my film, I feel like aesthetically is very influenced by the way that I always like to illustrate in my graphic diaries. There's a lot of small things. For example, I always had a big love for architecture, and for a big part of my life, I even considered following that. So I always try to incorporate unconsciously a lot of perspective and a lot of like detailed backgrounds. They are, as I said, they are always the starting point of my films. Or for example, I really like strong dark shadows, something that I always liked. And I like limited color palettes as well, which I incorporate in this film. What I always try to do is to find a way of combining, you know, both things that I like aesthetically, but also make it essential and important for the films conceptually. So I think that my love for architecture and perspective was helpful for the film to enhance that vertigo effect that I think it was important to convey. I think the dark shadows help to add a bit of a dramatic effect that I think also fits the film. When it comes to the limited color palette, you know, I liked the colors. They were important for me that I liked them, but I also, it was important for me to find a way of contrasting, you know, the warmer colors and more humane colors of the house and the characters with the more harsh and cold colors of the outside, the reality, you know. And so it's always a challenging for me to try to combine those two things. Although I don't use 3D for the final piece of the film, it's also very important for my process because I, you know, when I'm doing the pre-production phase, when I'm like discovering the world where the film is going to take place, I always model my film's movie set in 3D. And that's really helpful for me because it allows me to navigate virtually inside the film's location, like I was doing location scouting. And and it's very funny. It's a fun part because it's like playing Sims, you know, you're like creating those small things and now you're adjusting the chairs and everything. And that, for my head, helps having more ideas for the film as well.
Sara and Pamela, let's jump over to you. Tell us a little bit about the visual inspiration and the decision making you went through with regards to your film.
I think it was very much influenced by the script, actually, because Pamela put into the script this play with genres for each chapter, which I was super excited about. But the kind of the foundation of the film is kind of just a continuation of what I've been doing before, which is shooting a lot of reference footages and doing a lot of cut and paste to make a foundation that is very natural and character design that is based on real people. And then, we started there, which is something I've been doing for a long time. And then I asked my background painters I wanted the world to be somewhat realistic and painterly, but I didn't want it to feel like a memory. Like I wanted us to be in the moment with Pam. And then I had all these animation artists bring their own aesthetic into it. So I wasn't, you know, I what can I say? I wasn't in control of their, I just, what am I trying to say? I was like, I want you to work with me because your work is beautiful. And I knew what I was getting, but so there's a style and aesthetic in the film that is a mix of many people's art and also colored by the play of genre. So
one of the things we did before each chapter was get together with the artist who was going to be handling the fantasy elements, and we threw together like music and movies and images and all of the things that genre meant to us, so that it didn't have to stay firmly 90s in terms of everybody has this feeling, but through a 90s lens. So making sure that we were hitting some references of what Pam would have known at that time.
Real quick, I'm going to drag a relevant question from Atanas Shopsky. For you, Sara and Pam, did you draw over real footage? Did you first film?
Yeah, we did. So I've gotten really accustomed to, like I was saying, building this foundation of animation that is built on reference footages that we shoot. And because I think the beauty in animation really happens when you then take the animation away from that grounded feel that is easy maybe to connect to on a personal level. And that's where the poetry happens to me, for me. So yeah, we did shoot Pam a lot, Pam herself, myself and my husband, and then also some of the young actors, and actually also like some of Pam's friends and family who played the adults. We got to shoot them like over Zoom and ask them to do stuff on their phone. So maybe for one shot, I would maybe have 3 to 4 reference videos that the animators could take from to build right. their scene.
Peter, let's jump over to you. How did the look of the film come about? You know, what were the decisions that were made with regards to the visual style that you ultimately used for the film?
Well, the at its core was the art, Charlie's artwork from the book. We knew we wanted to do something that was very fully 2D in approach and kind of, I guess, quite simple. It's something that was, looked like traditional inked animation on, colored in with watercolor paints on watercolor backgrounds, basically. So that was in its simplest form, that's what we were aiming for. I think we wanted to, Charlie's drawings, some of them are just ink on paper. Some of them have, light watercolor backgrounds. He also works in charcoal and chalk and oil and all sorts of things. So there's a kind of mixture of stuff going on. But more often than not, they're sort of vignetted in the book, and there's a lot of white space on the page. We kind of knew we wanted to extend the world to something that was more sort of cinematic, and we didn't want to go into sort of vignettes or anything. We did explore trying to use some of the different techniques that he uses, and along the way we kind of, it all sort of coalesced onto just this one approach, I guess. And it's sort of based on the landscapes of Northern England, Northumberland, and the sort of Scottish borders. So we were looking at a lot of reference materials for that. And Charlie always talks about the space up there. There's sort of endless horizons. So we were, and the oak trees and things like that. So we just sort of, we're trying to kind of make that sort of world come to life, I guess.
How long did it take you with regards to your testing and, initial design work? Before you were comfortable, you had a satisfactory way to represent his drawings in an animated format.
Well, I mean, funnily enough, I would say we were quite far into production before we'd definitely started animating things. And before we had a sort of concept shot that really worked. I started doing sort of development stuff, I think in the December of 2020, I guess. And it was probably June or something before we had June or July. So a good 6 months probably of exploring, figuring things out. And at the same time as making an animatic and even starting layouts and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Lachlan, let's jump over to you. The smallest of stop motion production has a lot of very deliberate, puppet and set work that you have to, there's a lot of work that goes into it before you ever snap one frame. Tell us a little bit about your design process and how you arrived at the look of both your characters and the sets.
For me, you have to build everything before you can start animating. And I think I will always find ways to cut corners to get to that as soon as possible and spend as much time animating and figuring out the performances and things like that. And so, yeah, I think the looks of the puppets and the sets have this kind of like assembled look to it. And like, it's all sort of cobbled together with bits of different materials that feel like you could like visually deconstruct them and figure out how they were put together. And so the other part of it is I wanted it to feel as though you were there in the animator's space, like you're watching over their shoulder. And I was figuring out a way to do that in a way that I hadn't seen before. And I had a few ideas, but one of them was showing the film through like a camera monitor, and having a glimpse of what's happening in the studio around the monitor. So you kind of get a sense of that. Well, you, for one thing, you get a sense of the time like speeding by in front of your eyes, of just like the sporadic nature of a stop motion time lapse. And then I think that's, it's quite funny that then the animation is this mundane office workspace where it's very slow and repetitive, it's just a humorous thing that I wanted to play with.
What was the most challenging aspects of your film, of the production, whatever that may be, whatever that might entail? What was the toughest? What kept you up at night? What kept you pulling out your hair?
I think it's sort of the annoying things. It's like when you like come back to animate the day after and something's moved and you can't figure out how it moved or why it moved. And then you're fiddling around with it for hours. It's that kind of stuff that gets really challenging. I think it's the humidity or something. I've locked it like there's sandbags on everything. I don't know how. Anyways, so it's that kind of stuff that does my head in. So I've got to the point where like I will end like halfway through a quick action. So then if the next day something has moved, I can like cheat it a lot easier when things inevitably have moved while I sleep.
So you learn that lesson early on to save yourself time.
Yeah.
Joao, what about for you? What was the most challenging aspect of making your film?
I think one of the most challenging things about making this film was also one of the most fulfilling. So this film, I started this film as a student film as well, as a graduation film. And both my films that I did before, I had to do them by myself. They were also student films. And this one, you could say it was a semi-professional and semi-student film. We were very fortunate to get a budget. And that allowed us to get like a small team, amazing team. And so I had to do a lot of work that I wasn't used to do before in terms of pre-production, like making layouts for the people for Alan Nuno, the other animator who worked with me, to animate her shots, apart from animating my shots. Also preparing shots for people to color afterwards. So there was a lot of pre-production that I wasn't used to do because normally I knew what I had to do because I was working on the film. But after I passed that, like it was so beautiful just to see what everyone's personal touch added to the film. And so that's why I would say like it was a challenge at first, but at the end, I think it made a big difference in the film and I'm very happy and grateful I had the chance of working with these people.
Got it. Peter, what about for you? What was the toughest for you, or just for the production in general?
I think that one thing we found after we finished the film, just straight after finishing the film, we started making some little idents for the BBC as interstitials sort of thing. And by that stage, we kind of had figured out like how to do the process, you know, and they happened very, it was kind of very easy actually, because we'd sort of finally learned this language that we could then kind of speak. So I think, which it kind of demonstrated to me that actually almost like the discovering how this, the pipe, sort of the pipeline, the techniques, everything was all quite difficult. And it sort of, you know, it was only by the end of the film that we had a crew that could, you know, all of us, like not just the crew, but Charlie, myself, and, you know, producers, everyone who could speak this same language. I think so at the start, the start of the production, I guess the I think an interesting aspect of it is you know, having working with Charlie as a co-director. You know, Charlie always says Cara and myself had two jobs. One was to make the film, and one was to teach him how to make a film. And that is true. And I think you know, if you imagine where, you know, as sort of experienced filmmakers, you know, for example, like when you do a scribbly storyboard drawing, you know that it's going to be, you know, it's just part of the process, and you're using it as a sort of in a functional way to figure something out, and that, you know, by the end of, once it's been animated and inked and everything else, it will, if all good, being well, become beautiful. But I, you know, I remember those early days of showing Charlie's, you know, very rough storyboard drawings, and he was, I think, you know, scared of them, because they didn't look like his drawings, I think. So I think, you know, he has really, I think, strong and unique and special creative instincts, and at all times I wanted to just like listen to that and let him, you know, because they're his characters, it's his story, and you know, it was really at the core of it. It's like his, you know, his DNA is in the movie, but that process of him, you know, his learning to make films and our kind of learning from him, you know, became much easier. But that was challenging, I think, for him and for me and for everyone else to begin with, I think.
Right. So part of what you're saying is that by the time you were finally done with the film, you and the team were ready to actually, and had it wired so you could actually, then you were ready to make the film.
Yeah, exactly. It was like the whole production process was a piece of R&D, and we're like, right, finally, we can do it now. And then, you know, off we went.
Got it. Yeah. Sarah and Pamela, what about for you? What were the most challenging parts, either overall for the production or, you know, and for you individually?
Yeah, I think for me, it was keeping track of the schedule was, at least in the beginning, was the most challenging for me. This is the first time, like, it's funny because Pamela is coming from this gigantic animation, like coming from Disney and stuff, huge productions. But I'm used to working by myself or with one or two people with me. So this was the first time I had a real crew and a real pipeline and a real production schedule. And it made me nervous.
I think for me, some of the moments of the line you had to walk for this to work were challenging, because you were really trying to describe something you hadn't quite seen before, but you knew you were going to feel it when it got there. And there's so many people to get on the same page for that feeling to happen. And from where I'd come from in the pipeline, like, my job was usually to be in the back being like, I could write a different line, you know, maybe she'll say yes. But this was more like really being in there watching it and going, okay, right now it's too scary. Right now it's too flippant. Right now it's too real. Right now it's not real enough. And finding that line and trusting that line was exciting. Like, I'm really happy that was the challenge, because mm-hmm. I was really happy to have that challenge.
Sarah, just to go back to what you said, you know, kind of being nervous that you actually have more to work with in making this film than you're used to having in the work that you do. What did that enable you to embrace as you know, as a director, that you may not have been able to do on previous works without what you had to work with on this film?
Well, the movie's 25 minutes, which in animation is a lot of time. And I mean, I'm almost halfway to making a feature. And I'm very proud of us. I was just so excited when I got the opportunity to do this and have Pam's trust with it too, because it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful script. It's a beautiful writing. And it has all this play within it, which I was so intrigued by. And it's very personal, which is very something that's I find very interesting and like a fun space to work with. And it was on a scale where I was like, I can't do this. It's not, you know, I can't still like my arms can reach around this. But at the same time, I get to like work with all my favorite, like this was a dream project for me. And I was like, I get to work with all my favorite animation artists. I get to invite them both to do it with me, but also bring part of them, their own art to it. I don't know, this, like, I'm just so happy because I think some people face doing something incredible on their own and then maybe getting a big, you know, sometimes it can be problematic, I think, to get a really great big chance, but it can happen that you're not ready. So I felt like this was such a perfect next step for me from what I've been doing with animation, so.
And you were ready.
I have no idea if I'm answering your question.
You are, but basically you had an opportunity and you stepped up to it, and that's a challenge in itself.
Yeah, exactly.
Wendy and Amanda, let's go over to you. I know we've spoken about the film a number of times, and you've shared with me some of the challenges just from the standpoint of you brought, there's a number of different animation styles and visual pieces that you brought. It's an amalgam of a lot of different little decisions that I know took some time to do. Tell us a little bit about some of the challenges of how you decided this is what it's going to look like. This is how this film is going to be, and what was most difficult about making those decisions and getting this made.
Well, I think we can relate to things that everybody was saying. A lot, actually. I mean, Peter, when you said your whole process was making the film was R&D, that's how we work. It's very experimental. We develop our look, our technique, our structure, everything simultaneously, which is why, like when Sarah is talking about the first time working with big pipelines and crews, that's very intimidating for us because we're like a little cottage industry. It's mostly the two of us with a few other very talented people contributing. So we're always changing our mind. We're always reacting to the stuff we've just created and responding and we're aiming for aesthetic coherence. But in this film, you know, as you mentioned, Dan, we had a lot of different techniques sort of combined. And Lachlan, when you're talking about the perils of stop motion, I mean, Amanda and I have both worked under the camera back in the film days. And so we know very well, you know, we always call it seat of the pants animation. And so computers have completely changed that. But, you know, I mean, we really did for about 2 minutes consider building a model city on our dining room table. You can see it there. Mm-hmm. And then we thought, that's ridiculous. We have to blow it up and we'd have one chance, you know. So, and then there's all that smoke and debris and everything else. And so I would say that the biggest challenge was the 3D because it really was a big step for us. And we were intrigued by it, but very much out of our wheelhouse. And so when we started working with it, we didn't want it to be super slick, super whizzy. And also we didn't have the budget for that. But we found it challenging because we didn't know the software. And so that we had people with expertise working with us, and we were always surprised by how long things took. I mean, particles, the weight of them, the size of the files, the building smoke was huge, as Zane Kozak would know very well, a fellow who worked with us. It was a lot harder and more time consuming than we thought. So I think that was the biggest challenge, was that we're so used to doing it ourselves that we were not able to, and we felt a little bit out of our element in knowing what to expect from it. And also 3D looks like crap right up until the very end. That's the other thing, is that as it's being built, we had to have a lot of faith that this was going to come together. And it all came together. We worked a lot in After Effects with and if something was looking rough, we'd pull in more smoke, cover it with a little debris. editing, all these things, and color and filters and all that sort of thing brought these disparate things together. And as mentioned earlier, we had some live action in there. We have 2D animation. We actually have some real paint for these abstract sequences. You know, we had this outer space stuff. I mean, it was very varied, which was interesting. We kind of liked that. It was very collagey, but we worked hard to maintain a unity to it all.
For all the directors, this is from Sophie Corbett. What were the biggest changes between the first draft of your film and the final film? And why did you decide to make these changes?
Well, our very earliest ideas, way, way back, we featured the fish a lot more. We liked the, we originally had an idea where the, you know, how the fish would all be blown downward by the explosion and the sailor would be blown upward. And so we liked this kind of parallel or mirror path that they would take, ending close together at the end. And we pursued that a little bit, but it just took away from the sailor. We just, every time we left the sailor, we felt like we lost something. And so the fish became more incidental. I mean, really, he's the only other character in the film. So he has a major role. He, she, I don't know. But that was one major difference. But from the very first draft, it actually didn't change that much structurally and in terms of what we were trying to portray. It got a lot tighter and I hope smarter, but yeah, it stayed much the same.
Well, we couldn't mess too much with the structure because we had this prologue that needed to set up the situation of the ships and the explosion as efficiently as possible, because for us, the film really began at the explosion. And then the sailor goes up and he comes down, and everything in between was the meat of the film. And we messed with that a lot, and we knew that it would be not random, but that was an editing process. But we could mix it up in quite different ways and it would still be the same film. But yeah, the structure was always very clear to us, and that it didn't change a whole lot.
Okay. Joao, what about for you?
In my case, I think the thing that changed the most was the film's length. Initially, I think I made a storyboard for 7 minutes. Then I made a new version for 11 minutes, and finally for 14 minutes and a half. I think what changed was me understanding that I think the story could be told in 7 or 8 minutes, but I felt that I needed a bit more time for the film to breathe. And so there were some connections with the characters that we see them interacting. So there was a lot of space that I added in the film's structure overall. I think that was the biggest change, yeah, along the way.
Okay. Sara and Pamela, what about for you?
We cut so many jokes for time.
Is that hard to do?
No, because what's great is you get, once it's off the script and on the screen, you get to see jokes that you can't have in the script in the same way. So it doesn't need all the words that it needs to convey to get to the next step. So that's just me lightning round answering you. But it also was, I hadn't worked in 2D before. So recording first was very new to me. That was different. Like this has a lot of talking in it and that we were just going to stick with it was, that was scary.
Yeah. And I think maybe, and I was just like very much like a Nazi. I was just like, Pam, once we are happy with a storyboard, we are not touching it ever. But also I think from script to storyboards, we actually like there were, yeah, sure. We cut some stuff for time, but it didn't really change that much. It's kind of amazing. And also I think the chapter that maybe we messed around with the most in the animatic stage was Sweet One.
Okay. Yeah, definitely.
Lachlan, what about for you?
I think there was a lot in the script that I hadn't, I guess visually, couldn't visualize in the script. Like the whole monitor outside the monitor thing, like when I was doing the animatic, that wasn't fit. Like I just put that to the side and okay, let's just focus what's happening inside the monitor and then play around with that afterwards. And so yeah, I think that would probably be the main thing, even though that was kind of written in the script that there would be something, you'd be able to see more than just the film playing out. I just didn't know how that was going to look till later on.
Okay. And Peter, now we're coming back to you.
Yeah, well, I think in the early draft of the scripts, well, going back a step, actually, in the book, there are several moments where it feels a bit like the fourth wall is broken or something. So there's a page where there's a teacup stain where Charlie's just left a cup of tea on his drawing, and then he's actually made something of it in the moon or something. And the Moses notes a teacup stain, and there's another moment with where his dog kind of mashed up one of the pages, and that went in the book as well. So there, and so in the early drafts of the film script, there were those kind of more irreverent and sort of fourth wall breaking moments, I guess, including and the big one being a song. There's some drawings, I think, in the inside cover of the book of the characters kind of walking along some staves, and there was at one point that we were thinking of including a song in the film with that sort of thing going on. And they're probably the biggest changes that stand out to me.
Want to ask all of you, from kind of the start of principal pre-production, like when this really became a project in earnest, until you completed, how long did the films take to make, and roughly how many people were on the production?
It was 2 years and 120 people, I think. Not 120 people for the entire time, but in total.
Okay. Winnie and Manny, you mentioned a little bit you had a small crew. Tell us, how long did the film take, and ultimately how many people did you have working with you on it?
Well, if you get rid of the 16 or 17 intervening years, it took about 3 years to make. And we had a crew of, I would say, 8, not full-time. We, of course, Wendy and I were full-time.
I'd say smaller than that, but I mean,
apart
from us, somebody who contributed animation, Maya, some After Effects, occasional help, and then some people contributed some smoke and
mirrors,
smoke and mirrors. Yeah. And that's so apart from sound's another thing, but so that's pretty small.
That's apart from the whole administrative crew at the National Film Board, of course.
Right. Right. Joao, what about for you?
Yeah. So the film took roughly 2 years to make. I did some stops in the middle because I was doing some commissions. So yeah, I started in school and I kept working on it after graduating. It was roughly 2 years. And in the animation department, our film was very small. It was just me and another person. And the film is almost 15 minutes. And so each of us roughly animated 7 minutes and a half. And we had more people then helping with the coloring. We had a team from Portugal, France, UK, and Poland to help us doing the coloring, which was very, very important to color the characters. And we had actually a bigger team in the sound and music department, with all adding the musicians and the sound technicians and sound engineers, sound designers. So yeah, in a weird way, we had like a bigger team in the sound department than the animation department.
Okay.
I think it's absolutely amazing, Joao, that you managed to do that with two animators.
It was really intense. I'm not doing that again.
Another thing that you were animating Photoshop, which is extraordinary as well.
Yeah, I really hate myself sometimes.
Yeah, that's the other. I guess that's another question. Would you ever do a film like this again? And I think, Joao, you just said no. Sarah and Pamela, what about for you? How long to make, and how big a team?
Once we started working together and the scripts were all ready at that point, we spent a year and a half. And I think we counted at some point 25 people with everything included, sound, cast, crew, everything, 25.
Mm-hmm. And Lachlan, what about for you?
For me, aside from voice actors and such, it was myself and two university supervisors. So it was me building all the puppets and sets and animating, and then I'd meet with my supervisors regularly and bounce ideas and yeah, keep me sane along the way as well.
There's another question I'd like to ask, and again, this is for all of you. This comes from Alice Guarini, and I'm gonna edit it a little bit to make it relevant across the board. What's the one thing that you feel you did right as a student, or let's say earlier in your career, which helped you where you are today and helped you on your most current work?
Yeah. See, if I'm honest with myself, I don't know if I did the right thing. So
the answer is nothing.
But like, I think it is sort of just, well, I've made a decision, so I'm going to stick with it. Even if, yeah, I'm not sure if it was the right thing. That's,
okay.
That's fair, my response.
Sarah and Pamela, what about for each of you?
I moved around a lot. I went to 13 schools, and in grade school, I would move every 6 months, which was not great then. But it certainly taught me how to, well, make a found family very quickly, and hold on to memories in a way that I think is a little, I now know, different than a lot of people do, hang on to their memories. And so all of that, it went into making this film, whether or not I was aware that I was doing it at the time. It is only through answering these kinds of questions that I've been like, oh yeah, I think you can put it together.
Sarah, before you answer, Pamela, how many of those people, were you able to like stay in contact with them years later? Or was it really just, you know, hello, great to be friends and move on?
You know, in the early days of Facebook and when people were like, what is the internet? I was able to reconnect with a lot of people. But I still have, you know, some of the boys in the memoir from sixth grade. And, you know, I still know a couple of people from second, third grade, but not many. And I never really knew what it was like to be the one who was there and then took off. Like, did they remember me in the same way? Probably not. But there have been a few I've been able to stay in touch with.
Okay. And Sarah, what about for you?
When I went to animation school, I had no background in animation. I had background in fine art. And I got a little bit obsessed with animation. And I think I worked really hard when I was in school. And I think... that's something that has helped me most, not minding how hard you have to work to make the animation happen. And that just realizing that you have to be a little bit obsessed with it.
Joao, what about for you?
In my case, I think there was one really important thing that happened, which was accidental in a way, because I did my first student film. I think 6 years ago. It was called Voyager, and it was very important for me because I did that film in a multimedia arts course before actually starting to study animation. So I had this film, and I didn't have like beautiful things to like distract viewers from with the animation. And I think that forced me to learn, you know, more about editing, about directing, because I had to convey the story without relying on animation. And so ironically, like I think making an animation film without having studied animation was very important for me to learn how to be a better director in the future when I actually was able to learn how to properly animate and combine both things.
Got it. Wendy and Amanda, what about for you? I know there's some live action schooling as well way back when. So what did the early years, what'd you do right? What'd you learn that you look back and say, no, that was good that we learned that then. And that helps you either in this film or in other stuff you're doing now.
Well, the first thing we always say to students is make a film, make a film and just finish the damn thing. Because as we know, that can be tremendously challenging when you're in school. And I think some people think they just need to have a reel, but there's nothing like doing it to learn it. And, I would probably point to that as the single deciding factor, because it really shows people what you're made of. It's such a simple answer,
perhaps inadequate, but but also, we met in art school, and neither of us went to animation school really, even though there was an animation course, but it wasn't, you don't learn the kind of studio, big studio animation.
We still don't know how to do that.
Yeah, we don't know how to do that. But
confession.
But we did both study live action filmmaking before animation. And I think that that was important too, because I think it's, animation can sometimes distract from making an animated film a little bit. Like, I think that more importantly, it is concept, structure, editing, all those things. I mean, of course, beautiful animation is a beautiful thing and important, but I think that we were thinking more as filmmakers first before being animators. And I think that's maybe an important ingredient, at least for our work anyway.
Okay. And Peter, what about for you?
I think kind of just exactly what Amanda said, that, you know, just there was a moment, originally I studied architecture, and there was a moment where I thought, not sure about this. So then I gave animation a go, but I didn't go to a film school. I did a kind of practical animation training thing. But the year after I finished, or even just a few months after I finished, I decided to apply to get some money to make a film, and just making a film.
Have you all written and memorized your acceptance speeches yet?
I think Charlie's going to make an acceptance speech, you know, hypothetically, if that happens.
Okay, Pamela, what about for you?
No, only when I'm washing the dishes.
Wendy and Amanda, what about for you?
In a word, no. Maybe doing the dishes. I would confess to that, but that's about as far as we've gotten. Maybe once we're in the limo going
to Dan said we had to have these memorized. I didn't even know that. I'm not gonna be memorized.
What, there's no teleprompter?
I'm just gonna be pulling things out of bras.
Yeah, exactly.
Chua, what about for you?
Yeah. No,
have you thought about that yet?
I haven't as well. I'll probably think of some hypothetical speech like the day before while taking a bath, like, well, I'm really anxious or something like that, I think. But no, I have.
And Lachlan, what about for you?
No, me neither. I think it would be helpful just in case to know the list of people. Because that sucks if you forget to mention the right people. And I've done that before. I'll memorize that.
I'm going to go out on a limb and ask and keep you guys all here for one more question, because it's a really good question, and I think it will be a good way to kind of wrap up the discussion. And Amanda and Wendy, I'm going to come back to you, because you already kind of broached this subject. And the question came in from Anna Akultsen, and it's a word of advice for animation students and new emerging artists. And I know, Amanda, when you said, you know, make a film and finish a film. And I've always, in talking to people, I've always said, even if it's a 30-second film, you know, make it and finish it. And that's an important thing to do from a standpoint of, young filmmakers and students.
Yeah, that absolutely stands. I also think that one of your critical jobs as a student is to start to understand your internal voices better, when you're making excuses, when you have legitimate doubts about your work, when you need to trust yourself, because that's a process. You don't know how to do that when you start out, and then also how to receive criticism from others when it sits in a way that makes you uncomfortable enough that you think, yep, they're right, or you think, nope, they're wrong. But you have to learn all those things, all those those inner tells that you have.
Yeah, well, kind of related to that, one thing that we've noticed that helps, or I mean, I guess this is just sort of our process, is that you have to alternately be sort of tap into your subconscious, tap into your innate kind of
instincts,
yeah. Looseness, ideas, let them flow, let them gather. We call it our gathering stage. We just throw everything we can at the project. It's like throwing paint at a wall and seeing what sticks. And then you put on your other hat, which is your rigorous hat. And that's the one that judges what you've gathered and sifts through it and finds the film that that your subconscious has gathered the material for. And we alternate between those two modes in a way, but they're both equally important. You have to, you have to let that raw innate creativity run rampant. But then you really have to be rigorous and you have to ask yourself, is this an idea worth telling? Does this idea hold water? Does it make sense? And I'm not saying we get it right all the time, but those are the two alternating processes.
Peter, what about for you? What's your advice?
I think sounds glib maybe, but sort of follow the dream. Like if you have a sort of, if you kind of think you want to be a filmmaker or be an animator or, whatever it is, if you deep down know that's what you want to do, you just have to kind of keep going and just go for it and believe in yourself and just, keep practicing basically and keep doing it and make stuff, finish stuff, learn from it, and and don't kind of give up. I think I remember there's a time when I was confronted with I started thinking perhaps I should learn 3D animation and go into that world, and I remember thinking, well, it kind of would make a load of sense and there's loads of work there at the minute and all sorts of things, like all sorts of good reasons to go into that. But a bit of me, just in my heart, I was thinking, I just like 2D, there's less work there and, all sorts of, reasons not to do it, but I just thought, I'm just going to just go for it. And I think that for me, that was like a big, big moment. I just stuck to my guns and just carried on going. So, and I wasn't secure in that choice at all for many years, but like, now I feel it paid off, I guess, because I am managing to make a career of doing something that I really love doing. So I guess, just sort of believe that you can get there. You just need to keep working at it.
Joao, what about you? What's your advice?
Yeah, I agree with everything that has been said here. I also want to add something that I think I discovered along the process, not only of this film, but the other ones, that is that I feel like I learned that sometimes you end up like finding your best and most creative ideas also while embracing your own limitations. What do I mean by that? For example, the core of the film, for people who saw it, were the hats. And actually the hats were initially on the film just because I designed the characters wearing them, because at the time I was not comfortable about drawing hair on characters because I was at start and very recently doing animation. And I discovered that, you should, of course, learn everything that explore other areas, 3D to the animation, everything. But I also discovered that, sometimes finding creative solutions for your own technical gaps can be part of the process of finding your own artistic voice.
Sara and Pamela, what about you?
Yeah, the same as they've been saying, just like be stubborn, just be so stubborn and don't give up, right? And I often say to people who are thinking about going to film school or animation, like to learn anything in film or animation, especially if they're going into like a master's degree or something like that, it's such a valuable time in your life and you're paying a lot for to have this time, and you have this environment where you can make work, you can finish work, and you have all this system to help you make the work as best as possible. So I always say, if you're going to go to a master's degree, you're paying for it, be prepared and go in there knowing what you're going to make and make it and finish it, because it's the only way to break in is to have something to show.
I just wanted to add that if you are fortunate enough to get to work with a team and everybody that you're working with is as passionate as you are about the project, remember that they also will then have ownership. And there's something about working with a team when you're at the top of that team where you have to be so singularly focused. But if you're fortunate enough that everybody's top of their game and everybody's treating each other with respect, remember that feeling that they're giving you their notes with comes from their unique perspective into your film. So an actor with notes or an editor with notes, they're talking from their one way of knowing how to put their piece into this, like their expert advice. And so they aren't attacks. I learned this from a 3D world, but like it can feel like, oh my gosh, everybody's telling me what I'm doing wrong. But they're all telling you what they know is true to themselves in their heart. And that is how you make a great team.
Lachlan, we're going to finish up with you. What do you have to say?
Well, I really liked all your advice. Like I just was really enjoying that. I think for me to add, I have just finished a student degree, and I think a lot of the times you can't really you don't feel like you're getting better, or like day to day it doesn't feel like you're improving, and I think you definitely are, like a lot of times it's just you can't see it. And I think it is like everyone was saying, is like just stay stubborn or like keep making things, it's about sticking with it and following that passion.
To Peter, Wendy, and Amanda, Zhao, Sarah and Pamela, and Lachlan, first of all, congratulations on your nominations. Congratulations on some great work. And good luck to all of you. It's unfortunate that, you know, someone comes home with an award and there are others that don't, but I think you're all equally deserving, and I wish you all the best luck in coming up here. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Thank all of you out there in the audience. And of course, Maria Elena, thank you for putting this on. Everybody, don't forget, VIEW is October 15th to 20th in Turin. I'll be there. So if anybody who's here now, you'll see me there. Say hi. And thank you all for joining us.